I am your warrior, I am your justice, and for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution. These words, delivered at CPAC 2023, weren't just campaign rhetoric, they were a mission statement. Civil War historians immediately recognized the chilling echo. Similar language appeared in Confederate assassination plots against Lincoln. This wasn't about governing or vision, it was about vengeance wrapped in political packaging. Trump's third presidential bid represented something unprecedented in American democracy, a campaign built entirely on settling scores. "Vote for me," he promised, "and I will punish those who wronged you by wronging me." The personal had become political in the most dangerous way imaginable. When Trump arrived in Palm Beach on January 20, 2021, protesters lined the route with loser signs. Those first weeks felt like rock bottom. He'd abandoned golf rounds mid-game, leave dinner early, his mood swings visible to everyone. He found odd comfort as the club's impromptu DJ, playing YMCA on repeat, calling it the gay national anthem. This exile lasted 8 days. On January 28th, Kevin McCarthy arrived at Mar-a-Lago. The photos told the story. Both men smiling in Trump's ornate office, the supplicant and the king. That single image restored Trump as the party's de facto leader. McCarthy's calculation was simple. Better to appease Trump than risk him destroying the party. He got his speakership eventually, but the party paid an enormous price for accommodating a wounded, vindictive former president who would promote election deniers, attack fellow Republicans, and severely compromise electoral prospects. On January 6th, as rioters stormed the Capitol, Donald Trump sat in his private dining room watching Fox News. The presidential movement log was blank for 3 hours, not because records were erased, but because the president took no official actions while Congress was under attack. Trump later admitted he wanted to join the rioters twice that day. "I would have been very well received," he said, a chilling acknowledgement that the mob would have welcomed him. While Vice President Pence frantically called military leaders demanding National Guard deployment, Trump made no such calls. General Mark Milley testified, "Never once did we talk to President Trump during the entire attack." Instead, Trump continued working to overturn the election, calling senators to pressure them into rejecting Biden's electoral votes even as the building was under siege. When he finally tweeted asking supporters to stay peaceful, Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany testified that the president did not want to include any mention of peace in that tweet. Multiple staffers pleaded with him to intervene. He refused. Even as reports circulated of death threats against Pence, Trump remained passive, reportedly approving of the "Hang Mike Pence" chants. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos didn't just resign after January 6th. She first explored invoking the 25th Amendment with Vice President Pence, who refused. John Kelly stated he would have convened the cabinet to discuss removal had he still been serving. Most revealing were Trump's closest allies, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, two of his longest-serving loyalists, held serious discussions about the 25th Amendment. Under oath, Pompeo admitted the words 25th Amendment came up. Mnuchin conducted extensive online research and instructed his general counsel to investigate the constitutional mechanisms for removal. By 2022, Republican Governor Chris Sununu joked at the Gridiron Club dinner, "I don't think he's so crazy that you could put him in a mental institution, but I think if he were in one, he ain't getting out." This from a sitting Republican governor, demonstrating how widespread these concerns had become within his own party. To understand a second Trump administration, meet Johnny McGinty, a 30-year-old former college quarterback who became Trump's deputy president by late 2020. Joining the campaign at 25 with no qualification beyond Trump liking him, he was briefly fired in 2018 over gambling problems. He returned in February 2020 as director of the Presidential Personnel Office, controlling 4,000 political appointees across the executive branch. McGinty's little T enforcement was comically petty. Once, escalating to the chief of staff, a case where a HUD employee liked a Taylor Swift Instagram post featuring Biden-Harris cookies. His team of roughly 30 staffers, many in their 20s and some without college degrees, hunted for ideological enemies. One official described them as the most beautiful 20-year-old girls you could find, alongside guys who would be absolutely no threat to Johnny, earning the nickname the Rockets and the Dungeons & Dragons group. This was Trump's Red Guard, operating on the principle that you can learn policy, you can't learn loyalty. These inexperienced true believers represented the future, unqualified sycophants executing orders more experienced officials would refuse. After his June 13, 2023 arraignment, Trump pushed away his McDonald's meal aboard his private jet. At 77, he'd pleaded not guilty to 37 federal charges for mishandling classified documents, charges that could mean life in prison. His 2024 campaign had become a race against prosecution. Special Counsel Jack Smith's indictment revealed damning photographs, boxes of highly classified materials stacked throughout Mar-a-Lago, in bathrooms, ballrooms, and storage rooms where thousands of club members circulated freely. The documents contained America's most sensitive secrets about defense capabilities, nuclear programs, and military vulnerabilities. Most alarming were documents about United States nuclear programs, secrets classified by law under the Atomic Energy Acts that not even presidents can declassify, despite Trump's claims he could do so by thinking about it. On August 1, 2023, Trump became the 1,090th person charged in connection with the Capitol attack, this time for defrauding the United States. The mounting legal peril revealed a man running not just for power, but for survival. When Rusty Bowers, Arizona's Republican House Speaker, refused Trump and Giuliani's demands to nullify Biden's victory, he told them, "I will not break my oath." His family received death threats. His career ended. Congressman Tom Rice voted to impeach despite representing a South Carolina district Trump won by 20 points. He lost his primary by 27 points, but maintained, "I would do it again tomorrow." Liz Cheney paid the steepest price, losing her House leadership position and Wyoming seat. These profiles reveal both hope and horror. Hope because ordinary people performed extraordinary acts. Pence refusing to overturn the election, Justice Department officials threatening mass resignation, Supreme Court justices, including Trump appointees, rejecting his claims. The system held because Republicans in key positions acted as Americans rather than partisans. But the horror lies in how close Trump came to succeeding. Future historians examining Trump's presidential records will discover papers torn into pieces, remnants of his disregard for history and law. Among them, an Air Force One napkin bearing Trump's Sharpie-scrawled message, "Mitt Romney is a total loser." That napkin captures everything. A man so consumed by vengeance that even principled opposition warranted permanent, petty documentation. Democracy survived once because enough people chose country over party. The question isn't whether it can survive again, it's whether we'll demand leaders who don't force us to make that choice.